Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. One entry per person in case of duplicate prizes. Ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Vohini Vara, who has this book, The Immortal King Rao, which has some of the most incredible blurbs I've ever seen written about a book. And it is mind-blowing. It is three books in one. It's one of the most imaginative things I've ever read. So really looking forward to that. But first, we have Claude, award-winning Claude Jennings, doing the important work. David Aldrich, looking very somber. Looking very somber, professional for a Monday. And Jamie McIntyre's back. Welcome back.
You have a shirt on. What are you talking about?
It's nice.
I have a shirt on, a black-colored golf shirt, as a matter of fact.
Okay, well, now, David, you can. I'll now read your text out loud. Are we pronouncing her name? Am I pronouncing her name correctly? Do you think it is not?
I heard Wahini. That's why.
Okay, well, we'll ask her because I've kind of heard both.
But yes, exactly. That's why I didn't.
That'll be the polite thing. Jamie McIntyre, how are you?
You know, I'm doing well.
Good. Okay.
I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. So I have a few emails first up. And let's see. This one from Jeremy Johnson, which is a great name. A couple weeks ago, Jamie, we had on John Branch, New York Times reporter. Has this fabulous collection of his essays called Side Country. And one of his greatest stories in the book was about a Rubik's Cube championship. And his son is a Rubik's Cube champion. So Jeremy Johnson writes, I heard your interview with John Branch and the part about the Rubik's Cube and his son. Not as good as John's son, but when I was in high school, I carried a cube with me and could complete one in 35 seconds. So I've always been fascinated by them. Saw this kid, he has a link, on America's Got Talent this week and thought of John and his son. Wonder if this is a competitor of his son's. And if you just go to YouTube and find this, it is a kid who went on America's Got Talent. He's got a Rubik's Cube and you could tell everybody was just immediately bored. And he does one just like this in probably 15 seconds. So you think, okay, pretty good. But then he does one behind his back. Even, I think, faster. Then he shuts his eyes and does one. I don't know how you do that very quickly. Then he goes off stage, comes back on a unicycle and is doing them. And then he's juggling two while he does the Rubik's Cube and the other one. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible.
So, you know, Tori, there's a reason that you can do that without your eyes closed and all that is there's a specific sequence of moves that solves the Rubik's Cube. And once you memorize that sequence, as long as you start in the right spot, you don't need to look at the cube. My son could also solve the Rubik's Cube in about 30 seconds because he went to the trouble of memorizing the sequence of moves. And then, of course, they make it more difficult by adding more cubes. But you know, he never did it on a unicycle.
Okay, but how would you know where to start?
So I don't know how to solve the Rubik's Cube. My son Ian were here. He could tell you. But You start in a specific spot. And then after that, it's just like muscle memory. You move in a series of sequences in a specific order, and the cube resolves itself.
But you have to know what colors you're touching.
No, you don't. No, that's the secret. It's like a magic trick. It's like once you know the secret, then it's not magic anymore.
Okay, can we get Ian
that's
on the show?
Not to say it's not an amazing feat, but it does because you have to memorize the sequence of moves, and it's, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 moves. I don't know how many it takes to solve a Rubik's Cube.
Well, let's get Ian on the show and he can demonstrate. Does he still do it?
He could. Yeah. No, I
can get him. Cool. All right. Next time. All right. First email question for David. Mm-hmm. This is from Joanne Stern for David, a classic Chatter on Books question. And if you're on a deserted island and can download only one sports outlet, which one would it be other than The Athletic? P.S. I subscribe to The Athletic. So thank you for that. That's kind of a tough question for somebody who helps to run The Athletic.
Well, she's saying I can't.
Yeah, you can't pick The Athletic.
American University basketball. How about that?
There you go. Nice one.
That one.
I would pick the MLB app because it's free if you don't buy the upgrade. that's one big thing. Plus, it has all the stats on every game, and as you're watching the game, if you say what just happened there, you can go back and look at it. It shows all the replays, and again, it's free. And every time you have an argument about what happened in the eighth inning, you can go back and look at the summary of every play in the game. So, for a baseball fan, I like the MLB app.
Okay, good. Claude, what would you pick?
So I'm going to go with probably the most basic generic answer. I'll go ESPN. I mean, I just want to see everything. I need college football. I need NFL. I need golf. So
a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I just need it
and
all.
And then you can, if you really want to go deeper, you can go somewhere else. Did anybody watch? Okay, this was not going to be a sporty show, but here we go. Did anybody watch the Stanley Cup championship last night?
Sure, of course.
How about the end when the Colorado skater is falling, stops the puck with his skate, the blade comes off, and he has to crawl off the ice on his hands and knees.
That was pretty cool.
Pretty good ending.
Yes, no, happy for Colorado. They did a great job. Deserved
very
it.
Happy
in the league this year.
And as much as I would have loved to see the Caps repeat their Stanley Cup championship, which they didn't, I think it's better for sports when the same team doesn't win year after year.
Mm-hmm.
It's more just for everybody.
There's some argument against that, but it's your
really show. Oh no, give us the business side of it from say the Athletic perspective. Is it better to have dynasties?
It's not the Athletic. It is just people like dynasties. People watch dynasties. People, there's a reason the Yankees are the Yankees because they've won a lot and people are invested in this. People like why people watch Tom Brady, even though they may hate him and want him to lose because he wins all the time and you want to see if he wins again. So that there's something to be said for. I don't think it's any secret that the NBA's finals ratings went way up this year because guess what? The Warriors are back in the finals and everybody likes watching the Warriors.
Everybody likes watching Steve Kerr.
Well, you like
Stephen Steve Kerr. Okay, Jamie, you ready for your email?
Sure.
Okay, this is for Jeff from Pittsburgh. I know a Jeff in Pittsburgh, but I don't think it's that Jeff. Hi, blah, blah, blah. Love the show. Understand why you don't want to do politics on the show. No kidding. But kind of wish you would. Two questions for Jamie. If you hadn't gone into covering national security, but still wanted to be in journalism, what field would you have chosen?
So, my dream job was always, I always wanted to be the weatherman.
You always wanted to be the weatherman.
I wanted to be Charles Kuralt on CBS Sunday Morning.
Do you want to have a second family?
That's what I know. No, not that part. And I actually did. I actually did for a couple of years on Channel 9, a sort of a local version of CBS Sunday Morning that followed CBS Sunday Morning called Capital Edition.
Yeah.
I did that for a couple of years. And I was really known as a feature reporter. And I think I would have wanted to continue my career with feature and people stories and travel. And I sort of fell into the beat at the Pentagon. They needed somebody there. Wolf Blitzer had just been promoted to the White House, and I was a new reporter at CNN, and they sent me to the Pentagon. And of course, it's a terrific beat. And you know, once you've done that for so long, they don't want to take you off the beat, and then pretty much you're stuck. I got sort of stuck being a national security correspondent. But I would have been a sort of Charles Kuralt feature reporter if I had.
Okay, here's the Charles Kuralt trivia, and I think only Jamie would know this. The second family, his second family, had a spectacular place in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
He dies, big fight over this and that, whatever. The spectacular place in Montana gets sold. Who bought it?
I'm going to guess it was Ted Turner.
No.
Who?
No. Closer to your beat, my friend.
Oh, Donald Rumsfeld.
Donald Rumsfeld and Joyce Rumsfeld. I can't remember if Joyce was from Montana, but they always had this thing about Montana. And they said, let's spend some time in Montana. So they buy this ranch. Of course, didn't know about things like Charles Kuralt and the second wife, but bought the house from the second wife. And Joyce Rumsfeld, who has the greatest sense of humor on the planet, got a copy of the book that Charles Kuralt's second wife wrote, which was something like Second Family, and had it on the coffee table in the living room. Just so great.
Well, it's always good to honor the local history of the place.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, second question for Jamie. David, this is kind of, you can do this one too. Mm-hmm. Other than, because this is the 50th anniversary of Watergate, other than All the President's Men, can you recommend any good books on Watergate?
Well, you know, there's just a ton of books.
I know, but what's a good one?
So the one I really like, and I guess it's because I'm a journalist, is it was called... Woodward and Bernstein, Life in the Shadow of Watergate. It was by Alicia Shepard.
Very good.
Who I met when I was a graduate student at the University of Maryland. And she did a fan. Do you think so? You know, if you read All the President's Men, or if you saw the movie version, you know, you really got Woodward and Bernstein's version of what happened. But what Elisa Shepherd does is, and she goes back and gets the papers that they donated to some university, I forget which one, and goes through and she reconstructs everything that happened. And she sort of, there's a lot of myth busting. Like, for instance, if you read Woodward and Bernstein's book, you basically think they're the ones who did all the coverage of Watergate. And they were the first ones on the story. But once it broke, once it was obvious it was a big story, there were a lot of other reporters who broke a lot of the important aspects of the Watergate story. So I found that book to be fascinating because as a journalist, I always like people who are sort of setting the record straight and sort of busting the popular, the media-driven myth about what happened and bring more facts to it. And I saw it's a fascinating account. And also, it was written a while ago, but it was after Mark Felt came forward as Deep Throat. So it sort of includes, it sort of looks back, but it has pretty much all the context you're looking for. That's my favorite book on Watergate.
That's a good one. Okay, David?
That's a great book. I did like The Final Days, that Woodward wrote the sequel, because of the obvious information they got from Henry Kissinger and from Al Haig. And so it was pretty clear where they got their stuff from. And so you have to read it kind of with that critical eye and understand there were agendas there, but it doesn't change the fact that nobody has subsequently said that Nixon didn't get on his knees and ask Henry Kissinger to pray with him, you know? So, so I thought that it's a wonderful book. It's a great TikTok of that last year and a half, because again, to Jamie's point, you think that this all happened in like 6 weeks, and no, it's 2.5 years that it took from the break-in to the resignation. And it was a lot of days where that looked like, for lack of a better term, they were going to get away with it, you know? So, but understanding there were people who wanted to be heroic in that book. So
anytime you live through a time of history and you think, well, I kind of know about it because I lived through it.
Yeah.
And then you read an authoritative account, you know, decades later, you realize how little you knew at the time. And just a point of trivia, by the way, I attended the 1972 Republican National Convention in Miami, Florida, as a young person for the president.
That's a YPP, as you probably were called yourself?
Not to be confused with the Yippies that were in the park across the street. But the reason was my girlfriend at the time, her cousin was one of the White House counselors, and they wanted people to show that President Nixon had the support of young people, clean-cut young people, to contrast with the McGovern hippies. And when my girlfriend told me we could go to Miami for free on the dime of the Republican National Committee and hang out at the convention, I was all in. So
absolutely.
I still have my credential from that.
Did you wear a little navy blue jacket and a tie, I hope, a little
No, I didn't. And I had really long hair, too.
Okay, here's a pop quiz. Who was angrier than Donald Trump over the last week or so with the January 6th congressional hearings, which have been spectacular television? Who's angrier than anybody else?
Mark Meadows?
Nope. David? Claude?
I'm John Dean? I don't know.
Close. Bob Woodward.
Yeah.
Because four months, and Jamie, you know, David, you know, you guys all know this, for months, producers, bookers, all sorts of people, Bob Woodward, have been planning all sorts of appearances to talk about the 50th anniversary of Watergate. I always find it interesting. Bob clearly enjoys that spotlight more than Bernstein does. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Bernstein got more phone calls he did, but it's clearly a Bob Woodward thing. And it got completely overshadowed, as it should have been, mm-hmm. by the January 6th hearings, and a couple times last week, because if you want great television, it's those January 6th congressional hearings. A couple of times, Woodward will have some spot on, say, CNN. And they'll maybe say, and Bob Woodward, who was somewhat involved in the Watergate story of 50 years ago, we'd like to talk to you about what the congressional committee is finding. And you can just see him twitching. He is absolutely twitching. And there are comparisons, as there should be, between what Richard Nixon did and what Donald Trump did. Mm-hmm. And I think those of you watching News Channel 8 can say, I think one really outsizes the other, but he's very bummed.
I'm happy to say they're both really bad. How about we say
yeah. Really, really bad.
For different reasons. They're both really bad.
Yeah, really bad. And one might have created some opportunities for the other. Okay, yeah. Speaking of bad guys, before our guest, whose name I will triple check how we pronounce. I've had this one on the list for weeks, and we just keep running out of time. Can we talk about Harvey Weinstein?
It's your show, Tori.
Okay. We have. Right. Well, no, that's the point. So there was this thing a couple weeks ago, and Ron Charles from Washington Post wrote about it. A book gets released on Amazon about Harvey Weinstein, supposedly written by and with the cooperation of Harvey Weinstein in prison with a couple of other prisoners, from this guy who has started a quasi-publishing company that publishes works by felons. Mm-hmm. And it's up for a little while, and then there's some kerfuffle, and Amazon is told this isn't really legit, and these people didn't really work with Harvey Weinstein, so they pulled it down.
Yeah.
And in the same story, Ron Charles writes about how Ken Auletta, who's got an interesting relationship, shall we say, with Harvey Weinstein, has a book coming out in July. But my question is, and I was talking to some people about this the other day, how do you decide who do you have on the show? If you really don't like somebody, would you have them on the show?
Yeah.
But would you ever, okay, David, we'll do you first. Do you have any interest in reading anything by or about Harvey Weinstein?
Certainly not by Harvey Weinstein.
Okay.
It will be self-serving, much the way that whatever treacle that O.J. Simpson published post was, you know, it's completely self-serving. It serves no purpose other than to say, I'm not the bad person you think I am.
Right.
And in Weinstein's case, I guess they just ignore it. They just don't even mention it, which is ridiculous. But no, I wouldn't.
And I think my personal opinion is Ken Auletta is trying to correct some, you know, slings and arrows to his reputation. He got caught up in the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos thing.
Yeah.
He had written somewhat flattering things about Weinstein in the past,
right, what a
force he was in Hollywood, kind of alluding to the problems, but not addressing
right
them. So I think he may be trying to make up for that. But Jamie, anything by or about Harvey Weinstein, would you ever read it?
Well, I wouldn't seek it out. I wouldn't buy it. But if somebody gave me the book, I might look at it. I mean, the more somebody tells me that I shouldn't read a book, the more I start to get interested in just wondering what's in it. Like, I still haven't managed to pick up or find a copy of Woody Allen's book. That member got, I forget the title of it, but I think it was Apropos of Nothing was the name of his book.
Oh, right.
Canceled.
Yeah.
I think it got published in some form. Again, I wouldn't seek it. I wouldn't buy it, but I might be interested to see what he wrote. I'm a journalist. I like to hear the other side. And by the way, I have it on reliable sources that Donald Trump did not write the book, The Art of the Deal. You heard it here first.
I am stunned by this information, Jamie.
Okay, wait, let's back up for a minute, because Jamie, I think you were trying to say there was another side to Harvey Weinstein's story.
No, I would just be,
send your emails directly to Jamie.
There's a fascination with when people are caught and are, you know, guilty of something, how they try to rationalize, justify, and explain it. I might take a look at it. I'd probably read a chapter or two and then put it down and never pick it up again. But I wouldn't rule it out completely. I just wouldn't spend any money on it.
The Auletta piece is what would be interesting, because you remember, I think I've talked about this before, and I'm sure you guys remember the Joe McGinnis book about Fatal Vision, I think it was called.
Yeah, yeah,
about the
yep
army colonel that he thought was innocent. And then after being around him and seeing him, he went, oh my God, this guy did it. Like, he really did it. And he changed the book. And I think you're allowed to change your mind. More information comes in.
Yeah.
And so if Ken Auletta says, I thought this thing about Harvey Weinstein, but this massive amount of evidence shows me I was completely wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that's the book, I'm fine. Like Jamie said, I wouldn't seek it out, but I'd read it to see how.
A lot of people got fooled by that Theranos.
Yeah.
Thing. You got taken in.
Yeah.
Jamie, with all due respect, a lot of middle and older age white guys got sucked in by Elizabeth Holmes and the Theranos thing. I'm not kidding. If you looked at the reporters, if you looked at the people who went on the board, and Jamie, you and I know several of those people.
Yes, we do.
And if you look at even the original guys who backed her in Silicon Valley, they were aging white dinosaurs. And they were entranced by the notion of this young, energetic, vibrant woman in tech, and I'm going to support her. And those guys like that you and I used to know, I don't want to name too many names, but I will in a minute, who thought I used to be a lion of power. Yeah. And nobody pays attention to me anymore. And this way, they will pay attention to me again, and I will make a ton of money. And
well, people are captivated by the idea that there's some really novel new idea that's going to make that's going to be, in this case, great for humanity and make me a lot of money. Unlike Bitcoin or the cryptocurrency, which is just not going to make anybody any money at the moment. But people, look at how many people have gone all in on cryptocurrency, only to discover that it really isn't worth anything.
Okay, but wait, let's go back to this. So I will give, and our author probably heard us talking about the Stanley Cup championship and said, that's not my show. Not my show.
She got a brain in her head, she bailed.
Let's go back to this. I will sort of give a break to aging white guys who were suckered in by Elizabeth Holmes. I'll sort of give them a break. Right. I will not give a break to two categories of people. I will not give a break to the so-called scientists at drugstore chains and healthcare organizations who didn't do the due diligence to say, this is a crock of shit, right? Excuse me. And I will not give a break to the journalists. And I've read everything and watched everything and listened to every podcast. I know everything about this. And the number of so-called top-notch journalists like Ken Auletta, who just didn't even ask the most basic follow-up questions.
You're not getting Ken Auletta on the show. I'm pretty sure now.
Yeah, pretty sure. Pretty sure. I'm okay with that. Okay.
No, that's fair. But you know what? And I know, look, we're all susceptible to it. Whether you're a middle-aged white guy or not, we're all susceptible to two things, flattery and an easy story. We're all susceptible to it. And so if someone tells you, I have something that will make a car go 1,000 miles an hour and get 1,000,000 miles to the gallon, and I just need $10 million of seed money. Everybody wants to believe that there's something out there that's doable, that's easy, and nobody wants to go into the weeds of it.
Even a journalist, though, David, that's the job of a journalist.
I think some do, and yeah, to their credit, there were some who did ultimately write about Elizabeth Holmes, right, more critically. But in the nascent stages, we all want to believe there's this wonderful, great story that nobody else knows about, and I'm the only one that knows about it, and I'm going to.
Well, there's another factor that at play in journalism is that if you're a conservative reporter, and I mean this with a small c, in which you stick to the facts, you're highly skeptical, you write maybe about the Theranos thing, and you express some skepticism, point out that some things aren't verified or whatever, and you turn that story in, and this is not the case everywhere, but in many newsrooms, your editor's going to look at the other story written by the other guy that's really much flashier than your story.
Sexier.
And they don't know why you don't have,
that's right.
why you haven't, you need to punch this up. Look, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
And so the forces, it falls to the individual reporter to be able to stand up and say, no, I can't support that. And the pressure sometimes is just overwhelming.
Absolutely.
That your bosses and your editors want that really edgy story that pushes the envelope. And that's how a lot of this stuff gets written. And then people are under pressure to follow you, especially if you work for a major news organization, like say the New York Times or CNN, whatever.
Yeah. Well, also, and all those, in that same vein, Jamie, I take your point. So many of those outlets and publications that follow tech were under pressure. You've got to focus more on women in the technology sector. Mm-hmm. So it was great to have her on the cover of Wired magazine. Right. They loved that. And then there was a lot of chasing of that. But, God, just not the slightest due diligence.
Well, and there's another thing, and Jamie knows this. Reporters hate to say, you know what? I don't know. We hate that. We hate that. We hate not being authoritative. And, it's a lesson that we all need to learn. And sometimes you just don't know.
Yeah. And the other thing is when you go back to your editor and you say, I checked out that flashy story by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker. Yeah. And none of it checks out. The story is not there. And then they look at you like, Seymour Hersh, is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who broke the Mili story. And how could you possibly unit him? And And I'm just saying, well, I'm not saying anything about Timo Hirsch. I'm just saying this story doesn't check out. It's just they're not satisfied with that. They don't like that answer. And you have to be willing to, you have to have enough goodwill at your organization to be able to survive that. Because if you're new and young and just climbing up the ladder, you're going to be written off as somebody who's not aggressive enough.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, no, last question. Right. All right, our wonderful authors here, but I have to ask one more question. Stay with us. Jamie or David, you guys remember the worst snookering you ever were on the receiving end of? You know, somebody that completely fooled you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, that was fast.
Sure. I have some in mind.
Wow. Okay, Jamie answered first. Go, Jamie.
It's going to be, it's just a little.
Okay, Jamie, CNN headlines version.
It's
not
professionally embarrassing, but. During the Iraq War, some brilliant Marine commander came up with this idea of fooling the Iraqis into thinking that the invasion was starting so they could see how they would react, what they would do. So they decided that they would go to CNN and tell them that we'd have an exclusive interview with a commander in the field who was going to give us a big scoop. And we were a little suspicious about it, so we didn't do it live. We taped it. But then instead of a commander on the affairs guy and told us, you know, that it crossed the line of departure, the invasion was underway, we kind of went with it and discovered it was all a PSYOPs operation. We had egg all over our face. The worst part was David Martin came from CBS, came to interview me about how we got snookered on the story because he was doing a story about that.
Oh, nice.
That was pretty bad.
Okay, but Jamie, first tip off should have been if anybody used the word scoop, that should have just been your first tip off. Okay, right. Jamie, quickly.
I did a story, I remember very, very, very clearly about Master P, who was a rapper, still is a rapper, and how he was going to change the agent game. He was going to be this newfangled agent and get all these players and athletes, and he got a couple of guys to sign with him. And I said, this is the cutting edge. This is the next thing. This is the new paradigm. And it was nothing of the sort. It was complete nonsense. And, you have to own it. You have to say, all right, I blew that one. You know, you gotta wear it. You know, if you write something that's stupid, you got to say, you know what? That was stupid. I shouldn't have written that. You got to own it.
Yeah. My rule on when you make mistakes, which I make about 5,000 a day, is just grovel early.
Yeah.
apologize and grovel early and often and tend to move on. Okay, moving on. All right. I am so happy we get to talk about this wonderful book, The Immortal King Rao. First thing you have to do, David, how would you pronounce our author's name?
Well, I've heard Wahini and I've heard Vahini, and I want to make sure I'm right. I don't want to get it wrong.
I do too. Everybody
gets people's names wrong all the time.
And I think
how do you pronounce your name? Pronunciation? Is it a common pronunciation?
So it is pronounced like a W. It's pronounced Wahini.
Go, David.
You got it.
Wahini Farah, very nice to have you with us. So much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Okay, where do we find you today? What part of the world are you in?
So I am currently in a suburb of Seattle. I'm just visiting, though. I grew up in the Seattle area.
Yeah.
Seattle.
Staying in a friend's guest house. I was a little late because I was having internet problems, but it's a very, very nice guest house on the lake.
Nice.
And but normally I live in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Okay, but there should not be internet problems in Seattle.
Right, I know.
Should just work all the time. Okay, so I have so many questions about your book, which is spectacular, really spectacular. Jamie, it's the epitome of the unknown unknowns. I kept reading this book and I listened to it, Wahini, and I thought to myself, how does anyone even think of this, much less write so beautifully about it? But we love to get a little bit about the backstory, and I want to ask you about growing up because I was reading some interviews. And somewhere in there, I think you said something along the lines of absolute adherence to the rules of the academic game as a child, according to your mother's belief that that was the path to success. So what was your childhood like? Where were you from? How did you grow up? And then we'll get to how you became this great author.
Yeah, I grew up, I lived until I was 10 in Canada, in rural Canada. And had a pretty achievement oriented mom. I think that's where that came from. But for context, that line is from an essay I wrote about mischief, about the appeal of mischief. And so I don't know that my mom was like extraordinarily strict or anything like that, but like she was about following the rules at school. So I followed the rules at school. I always wanted to be a writer, and I always felt very supported in that by my family. I remember in middle school, I said something to my mom about, oh, by then we'd moved to Oklahoma. We moved to the U.S. And I said something to my mom about wanting to be a writer. And she said something like, well, as far as I know, like the one thing you can do to make a living as a writer is to be a journalist. So like, why don't you try for that? I was like, all right, okay, I'll be a journalist. And so, in high school, like I started working on my high school paper, and I was like writing creatively sort of like for myself on the side as we do. And by then we were living in the Seattle area. When I graduated high school, I went to college at Stanford and I started working on the school paper. And then I also minored in creative writing. So like I continued to do both in parallel, and then left college and immediately started working as a tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal, but still had like all these friends who are now my, you know, continue to be my lifelong friends who I'd met in undergrad with whom I, you know, would write fiction and share fiction.
Right. Okay. Hold that thought for a minute. David and then Jamie, because that's alphabetical. Were your parents supportive of you being journalists?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Were they?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There was never any.
Jamie?
My dad wanted everybody in our family to get a government job, but other than that, he supported me when I said I wanted to be a journalist.
Okay. So
when I was growing up and someone would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, my mom would always answer for me. He would say, Jamie wants to be a conservationist or a naturalist. She had that kind of accent.
What's a naturalist?
I didn't know.
What's a naturalist? I don't even know what that is.
I don't know. I guess it's like John Audubon or something.
Okay.
I think it's a conservationist without the license.
I didn't really know what I wanted to do until I got to college and I took a speech class where they actually, they had this newfangled device called a video tape recorder. This was in the 70s. And they taped our speeches we gave in the speech class. And I saw myself on TV and I said, you know, I could do that. I could do that. And I went to school to study journalism.
There you go. Okay, Wahini, back to you. In high school, what were you writing? What was your creative writing like?
Oh, God. I mean, I would like make up stories in my diary about like, you know, having a boyfriend or whatever. You know, it was not a high literary writing. Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I was playing around and like learning what it was to try to be a writer. I can't remember the details of anything I wrote, but I feel like it was like essentially my diary, but then I would make uh-huh. things so that like my life would sound better than
right. So I'm a little familiar with the culture at Stanford about the years that you were there. Creative writing was probably not the number one thing for most of your peers at Stanford, right? Did you find like-minded people taking those minoring in creative writing?
I did. You know, I think it might have changed a little after I left, but actually at the time that I was there, so Stanford has this program called the Stegner Fellowship Program, yeah. which is this probably like the best program in the country, maybe in the world for sort of like postgraduate studies. It's a right. postgraduate fellowship in creative writing. And so people would come to Stanford and do this fellowship, and then some of them would stay on and teach. And so if you were an undergrad and you were taking creative writing classes, you were taking some classes with people like Tobias Wolff and, you know, you know, like Elizabeth Talent, very, very accomplished writers in their field, because they were there primarily teaching the Stegner Fellows. And then they also taught us when they got a chance. And then you were also taking classes from these emerging writers. So my first creative writing teacher was a writer named Adam Johnson, who, you know, ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize mm-hmm. and is now one of the faculty members at Stanford. And then probably like equally importantly for me, I was taking classes with a number of friends who ended up pursuing careers in writing. So Karan Mahajan, Jenny Zhang, Tony Tulip-Moody, Anna North, very accomplished writers now who were all just sort of like figuring out how to write together with me. I will say, I mean, probably what you're alluding to, this was 2000 to 2004. So tech was starting to be a thing and Facebook was launched in 2004. Google went public in 2004. So when we graduated, like there were people in our class who like graduated and went off to work at Google or Facebook or whatever. But it was like, a pretty academically diverse place, and like nobody would look down on you for deciding to be a writer, at least in my experience. Like, it was, you know, there was plenty of support for that, I thought.
And then you found Iowa Writers Workshop and our friend Sam Chang, who's been on the show, who was fabulous. How was that?
It was amazing. Those were two of the best years of my life, I would say, of my writing life. I had two friends in college, Jenny Zhang and Anna Nora, who ended up going to Iowa to pursue, you know, a master's degree in creative writing while I was still working as a tech reporter. And so they were off doing that. I was still working on as a tech reporter and like starting to like miss that side of my life, the sort of more creative side of my writing life. And so I applied a year later. And when I got there, so I got in, and when I got there, these two friends of mine from undergrad were already there. And it was great. It was like Sam Chang had just become the director, maybe one or I think 2 years earlier or something, and was really starting to turn the place around, like really just affect this major cultural shift where previously there was this sort of like white male macho vibe at the place, or that was the reputation it had. I don't know how true that was. But then as soon as she came, like she started like really improving representation in the program, like changing the way things worked, making it more collaborative and less competitive. And like, that's the Iowa Writers Workshop that I came into.
Very cool. David, I think we have to get you to the Iowa Writers Workshop.
I would love
that. That'd be great.
And I would love that.
And you could beam in, you know, you're probably busy on Monday nights drinking beers or whatever.
I would love to, sit with people who are really thinking about how to be better writers, because that's what I would love to do for a while and think about, you know, and try stuff and fail. I want to fail, you know, because that's how you get better, I think. So I would love it if that ever.
You wrote that piece about the agent business, which was an epic failure, David. So, you know.
I think we all get.
No, I don't want to be too complimentary, but I actually think you have this failure thing down pat.
Yeah. You mastered that. Yeah. Okay, so let's start doing a segue to the Immortal King route, which is spectacular. So again, in the time you covered tech, Wall Street Journal, and an editor for the New Yorker on technology, correct? You've really got to know your stuff, and it's a lot of facts and figures. Is the Immortal King Rao, which is just so crazy creative and imaginative, is it kind of a reaction to what you had been doing in your career?
On the one hand, it was really informed by what I was doing in my career.
Sure.
So I left the journal and I took a leave of absence in 2008 and I went to grad school. And I thought I would, like, I was going to go and write short stories. Like, I just, you know, like, I didn't know what I was going to write about, but I didn't have any idea that I would write something about the tech industry. But I had been, like, writing about companies like Facebook and Microsoft and Oracle and meeting these people like Mark Zuckerberg and Larry Ellison and all these like wealthy and powerful and interesting and innovative tech executives. So in one sense, like that was swirling around in my mind. And when I sat down to write the book and realized that it was going to be a book about somebody who becomes a tech CEO, that part of the book, just like in the world building and all that, was very informed by my prior reporting as a tech reporter. And then later I went back to journalism and continued to write about tech and business. And so it continued to be informed by that. But then on the other hand, there's something freeing about, you know, if you want to write about like the sort of like inner psychology of a tech mogul, you're not going to sit down with one of these people and have them like tell you their deepest, darkest anxieties and secrets directly. Right. Like it's just, if there's nothing in it for them, it's not part of their job, but they have, you know, they almost have a disincentive to do that. You try to get at it as a journalist by like talking to people around that tech CEO, right? Like talking to the people close to them and getting them to tell you what their conversations have been like, but it's a little roundabout. So I've done some of that to kind of understand what made these people tick. But what I was able to do in the novel was like fully imagine myself into the mind of one of these people, which was really satisfying, which you can't do in journalism.
Yep. Okay. I'm going to read just the headline from Justin Taylor's review of the New York Times, your book, Family Saga, Capitalist Satire, Climate Thriller, Debut Novel, which is spectacular. But Jamie, ask the Jamie McIntyre question, please.
I thought you'd never get to it. So I'm famous for asking this question, but in this case, it really, I don't know. I'm really anxious to see how you answered this, which is, what is the story about? What's the book about?
So he, I've refined this over time. You'll be glad to know. People would ask me that at first, and I was like, I would be as flummoxed as anyone. But here's how I tell it now. I say, when the novel opens, the narrator, who is a young woman named Athena, is imprisoned, and she is accused of being somehow involved in the murder of her father. And then I say, her father is King Rao, the titular character in the book. King Rao grew up on a coconut grove in the south of India, and to a Dalit family, born into a Dalit family that's starting to see some upward mobility. He's a precocious kid. And when he's in the 1970s, when he's in his 20s, he moves to the US and starts a tech company, which eventually becomes like not just the biggest tech company in the world, but this like a world dominating company that eventually takes over all world governments. And King Rao becomes the most famous, powerful, wealthy person in the world. When the novel opens, he's had a fall from grace. He's sort of given birth, brought Athena into the world and raised her, you know, on this isolated island in the wake of his fall from grace. And so Athena is like telling this whole story of his life and her life as a way to like, partly as a way to exonerate herself and partly as a way to like come to some understanding of what she's here for and what she might be able to do to, you know, make the world a better place, whatever that means.
So, wow, that's so much better than the New York Times review. It's just confused the heck out of me.
So again, you took things that somebody could go, okay, I get it. Like a tech CEO, you know, mega, you know, Zuckerberg like character who goes on to fame and fortune, whatever, but you take it to an extraordinary level. And somebody could take this, you know, the story of Athena and the complex relationship with her father, but you take it to this extraordinary level. And then there's the whole thing about well, the world is ending and how do we change that? And you take it to another unbelievable level, but they're all intertwined. It's beautifully intertwined. Of those, say, three things, what was the hardest or the easiest or the most fun or the most challenging to work on of those three areas?
The hardest by far was the, I think what people think of as the main storyline. So the story of Athena making her way in the world and trying to do something in the sort of context of this world that her father has created. When I started the book, that didn't exist at all. And so the book was actually just the story of the rise and fall of King Rao. And there was someone narrating it who knew all about King Rao, but it was unclear who this voice was. Like, I didn't even know who this voice was. At first, like, there were some versions where this voice was like some kind of computer program who had been fed all of King's consciousness and memories. And then she was like an android who'd been built by King. And so she considered herself his daughter, but she wasn't really his daughter. And none of that worked. And finally she became Athena. I come from like a literary fiction background and not from a speculative, like the tradition of speculative or dystopian or sci-fi writing at all. Uh-huh. And so there were these basic skills that like, I just didn't have at first that I really, really had to learn. And it took me a long time. And like, I really labored over it. There was such a long period where it just didn't work at all. And it was kind of the last thing that came together. And so it's interesting to hear people talk about the book now. And like, in some ways that's been foregrounded, like the sort of story of Athena.
Sure.
Is foregrounded in people's conversations about the story of the story of the novel. But it's what was hardest for me.
Wow. So
in that first version where you have the anonymous sort of all-knowing narrator, isn't that referred to as third person omniscient voice?
Yeah, I mean, I was calling it at some point, and I think I might still call it this, like almost like a first person omniscient, right? Because there's like an actual character. It's not just like this sort of disembodied voice. There's like something telling the story, whether it was like Athena as it is now or some kind of computer program, right? Like the voice is emanating from some entity. So that's, necessarily first person. But then this entity sort of like knows a lot about the world, about other characters' consciousnesses. And so it was sort of like an experimental perspective or point of view, you know, to like be able to be both first person and omniscient at the same time.
There are so many aspects of this book that I could spend hours talking about. Talk to us about Algo. Talk to us about Algo.
Yeah.
And how it would be in charge of things like education or the criminal justice system?
Yeah. So Algo is this algorithm that this sort of like world dominant, you know, conglomeration of corporations is using to help make decisions about the way the world is run. And so like, if there's some policy decision that needs to be made about education or criminal justice, or any number of things, like Algo is able to take in a bunch of inputs and make a determination about what the policy outcome should be. And in the world of this book, like what Algo says is sort of considered, you know, like more, a better solution than anything that like a, you know, biased and less intelligent human could come up with. Of course, in reality, any algorithm is already inherently biased by the biases and shortcomings, right, of the humans who create it. Mm-hmm. And so that's true, as true for this algorithm as it is for any algorithm in our present day.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. I'm very, the book is so, gosh, it goes in so many different directions, but one of the central things that I really thought was interesting was the notion of our own duplicity in this, right? Like we all say we want everybody to be free and have rights, but we want to keep our 401ks and we don't want, and we want to have our McMansions and we don't want to share anything with anyone and NIMBYism and all that. What did your experience and then as you wrote it, what was your thought process about our own duplicity and kind of accepting this reality that there's that some business construct can make us all happy? Or happy enough that we ignore the bad stuff that they're doing on the side.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I think we have a tendency sometimes, like it makes life easier for us if we can blame, you know, Jeff Bezos for Amazon or blame Mark Zuckerberg for Facebook and Instagram, right? But the reality is that, well, there are many different realities involved here. One is that the people who run these companies are beholden to the shareholders of the company. And number one, many of us, whether it's through our 401k or through, you know, we're teachers and it's through our pension fund, are investors in these companies. So we actually are part owners of these companies and are sort of by definition responsible for what they do. And then another layer of this is that these companies would not be able to successfully do what they do and make money doing it if we as customers weren't participating in this economy as well, right? And so I think that's really important and interesting to talk about and think about. We also are the ones who created these systems in the first place, right? Like these systems that we use, whether they're just technology systems or systems of government, are things that we put together. You know, in the U.S., we're you know, at least on paper, a democracy, right? And so like we vote for the politicians who make decisions that determine the course of our lives. And so it that felt like really fertile ground to cover in a book, in part just because it's like sort of philosophically interesting. And then also because in any book, like you want your characters to have agency, right? Like you want to show how your characters are making decisions that they have some real hand in, right? And so that's some of what I was interested in trying to tackle.
Spectacular. Talk about your own experience with artificial intelligence and how that had an impact on the book. And by the way, I'm scared to death of AI. It's getting out of control.
Yeah.
It's going beyond us. But you've used it some, right? You used the AI writing tool.
Yeah. So let's see. My first experiences with AI were probably as a journalist. In 2018, I knew I was working on this novel that had something to do where AI was going to play some role.
Sure.
Right. And so I got this assignment with Fortune magazine to write a profile of this AI company in Canada. And it was partly because it was a fascinating company and partly because I just wanted to know, for the purposes of the novel, like how AI works, what the concerns are around it, right? What it's like to work in this corner of computer science. So I did that. Another story that I wrote around that time was a profile of somebody named Sam Altman, who is one of the founders of an AI lab called OpenAI in the Bay Area. And one of the products, one of the tools that this organization, OpenAI, makes is something called GPT-3, where it's like a text completion algorithm where you feed it some text and then it finishes your thought for you. Like it will finish a sentence or a paragraph. And so I wrote to Sam Altman, this was well after I had written that article, and said, hey, you know, I'm a creative writer. You know me as a journalist. I'm also a creative writer. I'm interested in playing around with this. Like, can you give me some access? So he and his, you know, PR team let me in to use OpenAI. And I realized as I was playing with GPT-3 that like the thing that it was most capable, like the thing where it could be most useful, is in kind of like helping a writer articulate something that you couldn't find the words for yourself, right? And for me, that thing is the death of my sister and my grief over the death of my sister. And so I started writing this essay in which I would write a little bit about my sister and her death and my grief and let GPT-3 complete it. And it was sort of like this iterative process where I started with one sentence and it completed it all wrong, you know, in a way that wasn't like emotionally or factually true. And then I gave it more and then it became true. Its response became truer. And then I gave it more and then it gradually became sort of like truer and truer to my experience. And I was, you know, I find in general, I find technology to be like, I think about it in a sort of value neutral way. Like it's just technology is something that we humans make. And it isn't inherently a good thing or a bad thing or good for us or bad for us. But like it's the sort of like the impact of technology depends a lot on who it is who's that's making it, like what their goals are. And as it happens, the people making technology tend to be wealthy, powerful investors who want to put their money into something and see that money grow, right? And so I think like that's the thing that has a potentially corrupting influence. And so when I think about this text completion tool, on one level, I'm just like, honestly, I'm like, this is really interesting and cool. Like using this technology helped me to articulate something that was hard for me to articulate. And I feel... you know, like I was moved by the experience. I was enriched by the experience, right? So like, that's true. And then it's also simultaneously true that like, if these kinds of technologies get really good, like maybe they'll be able to write a novel better than I can. Maybe they can write an article better than I can, right? And so like, my livelihood is potentially threatened by these kinds of technologies, you know? And I think both are true at the same time.
So when you're telling this story, it's jogging something in my memory. And I think I've heard this story before. Did you do this as a radio story or were you in a podcast about this?
Yes. You're remembering correctly, Jamie. So I published this essay in the magazine, The Believer, and then This American Life adapted it.
That's
and
right.
So I did an audio version of it for This American Life.
That's where I heard it.
Yeah.
There we go. It's spectacular. Okay. That makes me think of family. Let's get you out with this. And then subject you to 60 seconds more, which is just humiliating for all of us. There's a lot of family in this book, which I loved. There's so many wonderful parts to it, but that might be my favorite part of the whole book. How did your family feel about it? And I'm guessing I don't know how long you've been married, but I'm guessing the book took 12 years.
Yeah.
I'm guessing he was pretty happy it was done. But how did your family in general feel about the book?
Well, my immediate family is my husband and our 7-year-old. My husband is also a writer, which was very lucky in this case, because number one, he was my main reader. He read like many drafts of this book and gave me feedback. And then number two, like we do it to each other. Like we both have like bailed out of parenting duties and like family time and all that to write the book. So like he was thrilled when this book was done. I was thrilled when his last book is done and he was done, you know, but it feels like there's some parity in that way. Also, though, this book, the parts of the book set in India are based in part on my dad's family history. So my dad is Dalit and grew up on a coconut grove in the south of India. And, you know, when I was starting the book, I went and talked to a lot of relatives and spent time there on the family coconut grove, which still exists. And a lot of that informed the India parts of the book. I've been asked this question in the context of like, that concern that, you know, family members might bristle at the fact that you're sort of like revealing family secrets or writing about the family dirt. In this case, like my dad and all my extended family, my mom too, who's, you know, whose stories are also in the book, they sort of like universally were just, you know, proud and psyched that this history was being written about. Right. Coming from a South Indian background, which, you know, just as an being part of an immigrant family in the U.S. is sort of like a marginalized experience in the U.S. And then beyond that, coming from a Dalit family on my dad's side, there's sort of like all these aspects of my family experience that have not been talked about much in the U.S. And explored in the mainstream, you know, published. These stories have not been published by major publishers and, you know, written about in major papers. And so I think like seeing all that was gratifying for my family.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely should have been. The book is The Immortal King Rao. It's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. If you're into tech, if you're into family, if you're into climate change, it's all there. But thank you for writing it. Thank you so much for writing it. We wish you the best of luck. I hope you come back when you've got something else going on. And we'd love to see you again.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
All right, everybody. That's so spectacular. Moby Dick. That's the first person who's ever said.
Interesting.
First one that says she loves Moby Dick.
So that's funny because I would think like everybody would say Moby Dick and not Archie comic. So
no, there's a good hatred for Moby Dick out there.
That's great.
All right, gang. We are off next week for the 4th of July. Hope everybody has a great 4th of July. And then we're going to come back on July 11th, I believe it is, with Zane Asher, who is fabulous. She's been fabulous on CNN. Jamie, did you know Zane Asher? Like CNN International. Burgess. Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah. She's got a book where the children take us. It's an incredible story of sacrifices her parents made.
I did know Zane, but different last name when I knew
her. Yeah, Zane Asher. Absolutely fabulous. We've got her in July. In the meantime, everybody stay well, stay healthy, and thank you for listening. And we'll see you soon.
This is Chatter on Books. Use only as directed.